Hello, you're listening to a bonus episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. Scholar and author Clay Jenkinson is known to many listeners as the co-host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. You may also know that every year he visits Seattle to perform one of his historical interpretations. He calls it the highlight of his year. This time around, Jenkinson came in the guise of the soldier, geologist, and explorer John Wesley Powell. He focused on Powell's famous 1869 expedition down the Green and Colorado Rivers. It was the first known passage of Europeans through the Grand Canyon. Jenkinson always manages to bring to life a person, time, and place. If you haven't heard him before, you're in for a treat. And his tale of the Powell expedition may draw you back in time. This event took place on November 22nd at Town Hall Seattle. It was presented by Seattle Public Library as part of its 2015 McClellan O'Donnell Living History Series. Please be advised, the following piece contains a brief section of adult language, and apologies for the periodic scratchiness of our recording. Mr. Powell's long beard made a mess of modern recording technology. Here, Seattle Public Library's Chris Higashi makes the introductions.
Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's 2015 McClellan O'Donnell Living History Series and today's program with the great explorer, John Wesley Powell. The one-armed Civil War veteran, explorer, scientist, teacher, and a visionary. But first, let me say something about the person behind Mr. Powell, Clay Jenkinson. Clay is a celebrated humanities scholar, a writer, a film producer, and director of the Dakota Institute. Clay is the nation's leading first-person interpreter of Thomas Jefferson. You can listen to him weekly on the nationally syndicated radio program, The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Clay is also known for his portrayals of Theodore Roosevelt, Meriwether Lewis, J. Robert Oppenheimer, John Steinbeck, and more. We have been pleased to bring these historical figures to Seattle for the past 20 years, and we hope to do so for many more. John Wesley Powell is famous for an 1869 trip down the Green and Colorado Rivers, which included the first passage through the Grand Canyon. You are about to hear the stories of that arduous adventure and subsequent expeditions. John Wesley Powell is considered the most famous explorer of the West since Meriwether Lewis. Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great pleasure to introduce John Wesley Powell.
I lost this arm at the Battle of Shiloh during the Civil War. I was born in 1834 in upstate New York. My parents were hardscrabble farmers, Joseph and Mary Powell. And my father, to supplement his income, was an itinerant and circuit-riding Wesleyan minister. We moved from upstate New York to the southern part of Ohio, and from Ohio to several places in Illinois. In Illinois, we moved on to Wisconsin. And so I was a child of the middle border. My parents never amounted to much, and I probably would have had the same fate that they had, but for two things. First, my parents were ardent abolitionists. They believed that Negro slavery was an abomination. They believed that it must stop. They understood that the Civil War was about many things, but it was primarily about that. And because I imbibed their own emancipationist spirit, I was frequently bullied on the school grounds in southern Ohio. Southern Ohio was really in sympathy with the Confederacy. And when I was about 12, a farmer from the district by the name of George Crookham, an immense man, a failed farmer who had turned his barn into a scientific laboratory, he decided to rescue me. And so he came to my father, Joseph Powell, and said, "Britain, give me your son and I will make him a scholar. My father was reluctant to do that, but he did it. And this man, George Crookham, not only taught me to love field science, to go out collecting, to wander through swamps and go down rivers and climb mountains and search for fossils and so on, but he put the books into my hands that made the difference in my life. He put The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in my hands, and Polybius and Montesquieu and Tacitus. And so I never got a college degree of any sort. I attended a number of institutions before the Civil War, but it was George Crookham who made me the autodidact, the self-taught scientist that I became. So that was the first factor. The second factor was the Civil War. And when the war broke out, I immediately joined the 20th Illinois Volunteer Infantry and went off to save the Union. It seemed to me that we must win this war, that this was the greatest moral test of the American spirit that we would ever face, and that everyone who believed, as I did, that the war was righteous must volunteer. And so I distinguished myself as an artillerist. I worked on fortifications for Cape Girardeau. I impressed Ulysses S. Grant and John C. Fremont. And I was a minor officer, I would say, during the war. And it was at the Battle of Shiloh in Tennessee on April 6th, 1862, when I was leading a charge against a Confederate redoubt. And as I lifted my right arm to signal my men, a nearly spent Confederate mini ball, a bullet, struck me in the elbow and shattered it. The damage was so extensive that there was no repairing it. And so 2 days later, on the 8th of April, 1862, I sat without anesthetic of any sort as an army surgeon sawed off my arm above the elbow. I was one of the lucky ones. More than 800,000 Americans died in that war. Tens of thousands were maimed much more severely than I was. I never regarded this as a particular crippling. For the rest of my life, I used to cradle the stump with my left hand because the nerves regenerated, and when this jangled, it would send shooting pains to my heart. And in fact, when I was an older man in a part of the Washington establishment in the District of Columbia, my doctors recommended a second surgery. And then this one, again, without anesthetic, they used the tweezers to draw the nerves out from the stump. And that was more painful than being shot. You know what? I never let this maiming get in the way of anything that I wanted to do. In fact, on the great journeys on the Colorado River, it gave me an advantage because whenever we had to stop to portage around a waterfall, I would be dismissed because I was useless. And so I would climb up the sheer cliffs with a barometer on my back to do some geologizing, as I put it. But I never considered myself an invalid, and I never let that maiming stop me once. And in a certain sense, I regarded every day of my life after April 6th, 1862, as a bonus day, because I could so easily have been killed at Shiloh. And interestingly enough, there was a Confederate officer at Shiloh who was struck in the left arm and maimed there, and his arm was amputated. And so for the rest of my life at Christmas, I bought a fine pair of kid gloves and sent him one of them. This was my small token of national reconciliation. I had a kind of a wandering spirit. In 1855, I had taken a small wooden boat, a rowboat, all the way from Minneapolis, Minnesota to New Orleans on the Mississippi River. In 1856, I floated alone down the Ohio all the way from Pittsburgh to Cairo. In 1857, just for the fun of it, I walked across the entire state of Wisconsin. And in 1858, I went down the Illinois River and up the Mississippi and then up the Des Moines River. And in each case, I was testing myself, learning a little bit about field collection, trying to determine whether I had the capacity to be a serious field scientist. But after the war, there was a sort of seismic shift in the American spirit. Things that had satisfied us before no longer could. I remember Horace Greeley saying, "Go west, young man." The Civil War cut through the social fabric of this country like a hot knife through butter. And afterwards, there was a sense of restlessness that had never yet been seen in the American spirit. And so I was by then teaching at a couple of Illinois colleges, Illinois Normal and Illinois Wesleyan. And I decided to pull together a group of students and a few adults and go out to Colorado to collect specimens. And that first summer, 1867, we went to what's known as South Park, the area around Colorado Springs. And that year, my wife and I had married a woman named Emma Dean in 1861. And the two of us, plus some of our students, climbed Pikes Peak. And I believe that she was the first woman ever to climb Pikes Peak. The following year, I took a second group of students and amateurs to North and Middle Parks, up where the sources of the Grand River are in northern Colorado. And that year we climbed Long's Peak, the highest point in the state of Colorado, 14,255 feet. These were adventures, but they weren't enough. They didn't contribute much to science. They were really just recreational. And so that second year in 1868, I met a man named Jack Sumner, who was a Union veteran, and he was a kind of trapper and trailsman and guide out in the western parts of Colorado, and we concocted a scheme. We said, what if we put together a small group and we floated the entire distance of the canyons of the Green and the Colorado River? This was the last unexplored, uncharted, unmapped part of the United States. Lewis and Clark had given us the Pacific Northwest, and Zebulon Pike had gone up the Mississippi, and Fremont had done his work in the Great Basin. But there was this province, we called it the Colorado Plateau Province, that was essentially unknown. And so we decided that we would try to put together a little flotilla and go down from some access point on the Green or the Grand and float all the way to Baja. I couldn't find any money from any others to do this, so I just cobbled it together myself. I was fortunate the railroads agreed to ship anything that I might wish for free, and the United States Army allowed me to requisition some men and equipment from some of its forts. And so on May 24th, 1869, a group of 10 of us in four boats, four wooden dories, began our historic expedition. It was an expedition that had some pretensions to science. I brought barometers along so I could determine the altitude of the cliffs and thermometers. And we would map some of it. But of course, on the first run in such dangerous and unknown country, you really just hope to survive and come back another time. And so the people I gathered together were not professional scientists. In fact, I was the only one of them who had any pretensions to science at all. They were frontiersmen, the sort of people who are just reckless enough to go on a journey of this sort. And I had four stout wooden boats made in Chicago, Illinois, by the best boat maker in the United States. One, the pilot boat was 16 feet in length in pine. and the others were 24 feet and much stronger and had watertight compartments. And I gathered gear and so on. And we agreed to meet at a place called Green River Station on the Union Pacific Railroad in Wyoming. Let me tell you just a bit about the men that I gathered. There were four boats. The pilot boat was called the Emma Dean, after my wife Emma. And I was the captain of that boat, and with me was a man named J.C. Sumner. I've mentioned him already. Sumner kept a diary throughout. It's quite a remarkable document, quite frequently critical of me. But he was an extraordinary man, and his diary is one of the principal documents of the expedition. I remember, for example, that after the first couple of weeks when we were dunked in the river over and over again and lost our paddles and lost some of our food, and we became inured to the challenge of the river, and whenever we came to slack water, we were bored to tears and impatient with it. We wanted to get back into fast water. And he said once that, he said, it's like sparking a black-eyed girl, just dangerous enough to be interesting. So that's J.C. Sumner. Also in that boat was Bill Dunn. Bill Dunn was sort of the idea of a mountain man. He wore only buckskins. I never saw him in anything else. So far as I know, those were the only buckskins he had ever owned. His hair was jet black and it cascaded down his back all the way to his knees. And as far as I could tell, he had never once washed that hair in the whole course of his life. He had a sort of greasy, oleaginous appearance. But he was a very strong man and a good man, too. So that was the pilot craft, the Emma Dean. The second boat was called Kitty Clyde's Sister. And in it was my brother Walter and a man named George Bradley. Walter, my younger brother, was a very strong man, strong as an ox. But he had been captured during the war by the Confederates and placed in Andersonville prison camp. And he had escaped and been recaptured, and he had been tortured and lived with rats and mice and near starvation, and it had touched him. It had touched him in the head. And he was never really the same after that. I took him along on all of my expeditions. The men were a little frightened of him, but he was a gentle giant. They called him Old Shady because he sang that song, Up and Down the Green, in the Colorado Rivers. But Bradley, his mate in Kitty Clyde's Sister, turned out to be the best man of the expedition. And I met Bradley at a fort, at an army fort in Utah. He was a sarcastic man. He was an irascible and curmudgeonly man, but he was strong as a badger. When I met him, he said that he would agree to explore the river Styx if it would get him out of the army. And so I hired him. If you can imagine it, Bradley kept a secret diary through the entire expedition. And how he did this, I don't know, because we were hemmed in. There's no privacy on a voyage of this sort. We often slept head-to-head, all of us. How he managed to keep an entirely private diary that none of the rest knew about is one of the mysteries of the expedition, but it turned out to be a very valuable document, and he was even harder on me than Sumner had been. For example, he said, as usual, the major wants to float on the Sabbath. He was a New Englander. I didn't know what day was the Sabbath after the first couple of weeks, and we were by now in a race against starvation, so of course we had to run on Sundays. And he said once, as usual, the major has chosen the worst possible campsite in the river. And this is sometimes true, because when you're the first, you don't know what's around the next bend. There could be a beautiful beach 2 miles below, but you have no way of knowing this because you can't anticipate what you haven't yet explored. And so you stop about dusk because you have to stop somewhere. And, of course, it's easier to criticize than it is to make these decisions. But once I chose a spot that was so so poor. We nestled our blankets in amongst the rocks, and we were essentially in an upright position. And Bradley said this. He said, "If I had a dog that was willing to sleep where we camped tonight, I would kill that dog. And I would burn his collar, and I would swear that I never owned such a cur." But he had a great literary flair, and about 6 days into the expedition, he said, "Well, today we have found the worst rapids we're ever going to see." And then about a day later, he said, "No, today we have come to the worst rapids we're ever..." And then 4 or 5 days later, "No, these are the worst rapids." Finally, he said, "I'm not going to talk about it anymore because they just get worse and worse and worse." But at least 21 times in his journal, he says, "There can be no rapids worse than the ones we are about to attempt." So that was Kitty Clyde's sister. The Maid of the Canyon had two people in it, Billy Rhodes Hawkins, who was our cook. He had 5 or 6 names, so we reckoned he was on the lam from somewhere. And Andy Hall, who was just 20, he was a Scotsman. And finally, the fourth boat was piloted by Ormel Howland, who was a printer from Colorado Springs. In fact, he was one of the creators of the Rocky Mountain Journal. Ormel Howland and his younger brother, Seneca. And then an Englishman that we just happened to run into out there. He was a man from Britain. He came to the American West seeking adventure. He begged to come with us, and so we took him. His name was Frank Goodman. But those three were so unimaginative that they didn't even give their boat a name. So we had the Emma Dean, Kitty Clyde's sister, the Maid of the Canyon, and the No Name. And so we started out with this little motley crew on May 24th, 1869. I can't tell you all the stories of this, but let me try to give you a sense of it. We thought we would eat off of the land. We had rifles and fishing gear, and we thought we would kill bighorn sheep or mule deer or elk or something, but it was almost impossible to hunt. And for one thing, you're so deep into the earth, you know, half a mile into the earth. 3/4 of a mile into the earth, a full mile into the depths of the earth. And so it was almost impossible to hunt. And if you'd kill a bighorn sheep, you'd have to climb up and get it. And oftentimes it would disappear. They're very, very nimble creatures. And the fishing was no good either. We had taken 10 months worth of rations. When I say rations, I'm talking about very primitive food. Flour. Principally, we lived on biscuits. And those flour sacks went into the river over and over and over again. And they became sour and lumpy and moldy. And we had bacon. We had huge sides of bacon. And we would just cut off whatever was green and eat the rest. And we had some dried apples that were sort of the most avant-garde of the foods, and coffee and sugar and some beans. But this is not enough fuel for 10 men working at that level of challenge for 99 days. And so really the journey became a kind of race against starvation. By the time we came out at Grand Wash Cliffs on August 31st, 1869, we were emaciated. Our clothing was just rags. We looked like refugees from Robinson Crusoe. We had the beginnings of scurvy, and we were scared. Because when you're the first, you have no idea how long it's going to take to get out. And even I, the optimist, came to call the Grand Canyon our prison. I said, "When will we get out of this prison?" See, when you go down the Grand Canyon, how many of you, by the way, have gone down the canyons? When you do it, it's recreational. There are outfitters, there's a crew, the boats are infinitely better, and so on. But mostly you know what's around the next bend because someone was first. But when you're first, you have no idea. And we had been warned. The great James Beckwith, the black mountain man, had said on the Colorado River, there's a great suck. And the river actually goes underground for 5 or 10 or 15 miles. And whoever's in boats would just be swept into the interior of the planet. The Indians said, heap big danger. And we were told that there might even be a place where there's a falls, and the current was so strong that we couldn't back up, and the canyon would be so sheer on either side that there would be nowhere to tie off. And so it wasn't even clear that this could be done. And it certainly couldn't be done with the food supply and the gear that we had. And then we had a couple of very significant accidents. And the first one occurred just 10 days in. So we've flipped the boats and we've lost paddles and so on, but this is neither here nor there. About the 10th day in, I had devised a set of flag signals. And so when I saw particularly bad rapids, I would make the flag signal and we'd all come to shore and reconnoiter. And two of the other three boats followed suit, but the No Name, for whatever reason, it was never really clear, did not stop. And the No Name was swept down into the rapids in the canyon of Lodore. And after a couple of near misses, it hit sideways on a rock and split into two. And the three men, Orimel Howland, Seneca Howland, and Frank Goodman, were tossed out of the boat and into the river. They nearly drowned. They eventually washed up on an island, and we rescued them. When we got them back to shore, it was as if they had been on a transatlantic voyage. We hugged them because we'd been so worried about them. But with the wreck of the No Name, we lost fully a third of our provisions. So now we're 10 days in, 90 miles on a river that's going to be 1,000 miles long. We've lost fully a third of our provisions, all of the personal gear of those three men, their toiletries and their kit and their blankets and robes. And unfortunately, that day, I don't know why, it was just some sort of an error. We had put all of the scientific instruments in that single boat. So all of the barometers, the sextant, and the thermometers were in the No Name. Usually they were spread across all four, and now they're gone. So this is effectively the end of the expedition. I thought of packing it in. I thought of walking out to Salt Lake City, a distance of 300 miles, to buy barometers. But after we had a good meal, Jack Sumner came to me, and he said, "Major, I see part of the wreckage is lodged up against some rocks about half a mile downstream. Tomorrow morning, I think we should attempt a rescue mission and see if there's anything there." And so I agreed to this, and the next morning, after a good night of sleep, two of the men got in the Emma Dean, the small and more maneuverable pilot boat, and they eased their way across the river to the wreckage. Now keep in mind, if you've never done this, you can't hear a thing in the Grand Canyon. It's like the sound of 30 freight trains all of the time. The roaring and the whistling and the wind and the waves, everything's in pantomime. You can be standing 2 feet away from someone and shouting at them and they can't hear you. So all this occurred like a mime. And these two went off in the pilot boat and they made their way over to the wreckage and then they scrambled around for a time. We could just barely see them. But at a certain point, they began to cheer and wave. And so I reckoned that they had found some of the gear. When they came back, it's true, they had found all of the barometers and some of the thermometers. But the cheering wasn't really about science. I'm a teetotaler. And I had forbidden them to bring any alcohol on the expedition. But it turns out the men of the No Name had secreted a 3-gallon whiskey jug into that craft, and it had survived the accident at Disaster Falls. And this, I'm sorry to say, was their reason for exaltation. And so I made an executive decision to redefine that as medicinal spirits, because I reckoned that we would all need a nip before this journey was over. So now we're 10 days in. We've lost a third of everything, all of their personal kit. And a certain tension began to set in because I blamed them for not following orders. They were endangering not only the lives of the rest of us, but the scientific pretensions of the journey. What came later probably has something to do with that. But to give you a sense of this, I just want to recite a couple of passages. Here's one about cliffs. I said, today, two or three of us climb the cliff on the left and discover its altitude above camp to be 2,086 feet. On a rock, we find a pool of cool, clear water caught from yesterday evening's storm. After a good drink, we walk out to the brink of the canyon and look down on the river below. I could do this now, but it has taken several years of mountain climbing to steel my nerves so that I can sit with my legs dangling over a 2,000-foot cliff. And yet, I cannot look on and see anybody else do the same. I must either bid him come away or turn my head. In a certain sense, my journey was an ordeal. But in another sense, it was sublime. We were the first. We were in a very narrow slot that was 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 feet incised into the earth. A river like the Yellowstone, the Missouri, is on the surface, and in a big year, it jumps out of its banks and finds a new channel. But over eons, over millions and millions of years, the Green and the Colorado have dug down and incised into the very rocks at the heart of the earth. It's a geologist's paradise. If you try to do geology in Wales or Ireland or England, you have to remove all of the trees and shrubs and grasses first. But out in the arid lands of the West, it's all an open book. And these rivers have carved down millions and millions of years of sediments. We would look up and we would see 1,500 feet up some giant blocks that were larger than any blocks of any building in the world. Some of them looked like castles or minarets or fences or giant fortifications. It was as if God had come here with all of his materials and it just stopped in mid-creation. So there was a sort of deep, deep satisfaction in this journey, even when we were scared of it. Because we were the first, I had the duty of naming the features that we came to. And so here's my principle of naming. There are four ways to name. One is descriptive. The second is honorific. The third is literary. And the fourth is translation of Indian terms. And normally, I use descriptive. I don't like using people's names. You name some magnificent feature of the landscape after some minor bureaucrat at the Smithsonian. I did a little of this. The Escalante River, the Crossing of the Fathers, Ashley Falls, Vasey's Paradise. But on the whole, I didn't like to name things for people. It seemed like an irresponsibility of the imagination. We used a few literary terms, Bright Angel Falls, Dirty Devil Creek, Glen Canyon, the Canyon of Lodore. That actually came from a poem by the British romantic poet Southey. But I didn't really do much of that either. Mostly I used descriptive terms, Beehive Point, or Gray Canyon, Desolation Canyon, Marble Canyon, Split Rock, Flaming Gorge. Typically I name things just from their appearance, because their appearance alone was extraordinary. The fourth method was translation. And the best example of that, if you've ever been to Canyonlands National Park, it's where the two great tributaries of the river come together to form the True Colorado. We arrived there in early July of 1869. And I called that the standing up rock country, which translates a Ute term, tumpin winir to weep, standing up rock country. Isn't that beautiful? Tumpin winir to weep, the standing up rock country. So let me give you a passage from my journal that talks about how I named one feature. At night we camp on the right bank, on a little shelving rock between the river and the foot of the cliffs. And with night comes gloom into those great depths. After supper, we sit by our campfire made of driftwood caught by the rocks and tell stories of wildlife. For the men have seen such in the mountains or on the plains and around the battlefields of the South. It is late before we spread our blankets on the beach. Lying down, we can look up through the canyon and see just a little of the bright heavens overhead, a crescent of blue sky with two or three constellations peering down upon us. I do not sleep for some time, as the excitement of the day has not yet worn off. Soon I see a bright star that appears to rest on the very brink of the canyon overhead to the east. And then slowly it begins to float free of its resting place. I almost wonder that it does not fall. Indeed, the bright sky in which the stars are set appears to be spread across the canyon, anchored on both rims and swayed down by its own weight. The stars appear to be in the canyon. It soon becomes clear to me that this is the star known as Vega, which is part of the constellation of the Harp. So I determined to name this point the Cliff of the Harp. So that's how it worked. That's the joy of being the explorer, is that you need to examine what you see and bring to bear all of your education and all of your descriptive powers and to try to capture it somehow for those who will come afterwards. Well, to hasten forward, by the time we reached the mouth of the Little Colorado River, excuse me, we were exhausted, we were malnourished, our boats were leaking like a sieve, we would caulk them one, two, three times per day. We were scared. So when you begin the Grand Canyon, which is so much more dramatic than anything that comes before it, you need to be at full strength. But when we started down the Grand Canyon, we weren't at full strength at all. We were spent. And so that contributed to what followed. And I remember the moment when we were about to shove off from the mouth of the Little Colorado, the Chiquita River. This is what I wrote in my diary. We are now ready to begin on our way down the great unknown. Our boats, tied to a common stake, chafe each other as they are tossed by the fretful river. They ride high and buoyant, for their loads are lighter than we could wish. We have but a month's rations remaining. Our flour has been re-sifted through our mosquito net sieve. Our spoiled bacon has been dried and the worst of it boiled. Our few pounds of dried apples have been spread in the sun and reshrunken to their normal bulk. Our sugar has long since melted and gone on its way down the river, but we have a large supply of coffee. The lightening of the boats will have this one advantage. They will ride the waves better, and we shall have but little to carry in the event of a portage. We are now 3/4 of a mile in the depths of the earth, and the great river shrinks into insignificance as it tosses its angry waves at the walls and cliffs that rise to the world above. Its waves are but puny ripples, and we but pygmies running up and down the sand or lost among the boulders. We have an unknown canyon yet to explore, an unknown river to run. What falls there may be, we know not. What rocks beset the channel, we know not. What walls rise over the river, we know not. Ah, well, the men talk as cheerfully as ever this morning. Jests are bandied about freely among them. And yet to me, the cheer is somber and the jests are ghastly. And so we began. And each day we came to more and more and more dramatic falls. Until finally, on the 27th of August, we came to one so appalling that there was nobody who believed we could run it. Now, here's what we didn't know. We were less than 2 days from coming out. But you couldn't know that then. It could have been 6 days or 60 days. We were just 2 days from coming out to Grand Wash Cliffs, where the cliffs fall away and the river becomes like any other river in the world. But we couldn't know that. And so after supper, that night, Orimal Howland came to me, and he took me aside, and he said, "Major, we can't go on. It's suicide to go on. Nobody can survive this rapids." He said, "The only thing to do is to quit. Somehow we'll climb out the north rim, even though it's more than a mile in the air. We'll come back another year and finish, but we just can't do it. And if you try to do it, all that you've achieved so far will be lost." I asked him if anyone agreed with him, and he said, yes, his brother Seneca and Bill Dunn, that the three of them were determined that we must stop. I went to each of the other men and woke them up. By now they were all asleep. And I asked each one in turn what his disposition was. And all the rest said that they would stay with me through thick or thin, and they were determined to let me decide. And so I went back to Orimal Howland and tried to persuade him, but there was no persuading him. And here's what I wrote in my diary. I said, "After our talk, he lay down again, but for me, there is no sleep. All night long, I walk up and down a few yards of sand beach along by the river. Is it wise to go on? I go to the boats again to look at our rations. I feel certain we can get over the impediments immediately before us. What there may be below, I know not. From our position yesterday, high up on the rocks, we saw that the river makes another great bend to the south, which from our experience heretofore means more and higher granite walls, and thus worse rapids. I am not sure we can climb out of the canyon here. And when at the top of the walls, I know enough of the surrounding countryside to be certain that it is a desert of rock and sand between this and the nearest Mormon village, which, on the most direct line, must be at least 75 miles away. At one time, I almost determined to leave the river. But to say that there is a part of the canyon that I cannot explore, a part of the river that I cannot run, having already almost accomplished it, is more than I am willing to acknowledge. And I determined to go on." Well, the next morning was like a funeral. Billy Rhodes Hawkins baked up all the last of the biscuits. We had lost our soda months earlier, so these were unleavened biscuits. We baked every piece of flour we had and divided it into two little piles. We gave the three deserters rifles and letters to our families in case we died, and personal effects. I gave my gold watch to one of them. It was silent. We didn't say a word at breakfast. And then they started climbing up the north rim of the Grand Canyon, a full mile to the top. And now we had no choice. The rest of us, we had no choice but to run that rapids. We later called them separation rapids. Bradley, as usual, said he would be the pilot. What we did was tied all of our ropes together, and we tried to line him down this unbelievable and appalling falls. We thought if we could line him down with ropes and still hang on to him, maybe we could ease him through. But he got out a couple of hundred yards with that rope, and then a pendulum effect began, and his boat started to go from one wall to the other wall and back and forth with greater and greater speed, and he would tap the wall, and then he would bang into the wall, and then he would bang hard into the wall. It was clear that he was going to be smashed to smithereens. So he took his pocket knife out. He had a cowboy hat on. He took his pocket knife out, and he cut the rope. When he did, his boat jumped about 20 feet into the air, and it disappeared over the falls. And we just knew he was dead, and we began to grieve. But about 2 minutes later, somewhere down the stream, he popped up like a cork, more dead than alive, and he waved his hat like a rodeo cowboy, and somehow he had lived. So the rest of us just jumped in one of the last boats, and we didn't even use a rope. We just went over the falls, just decided to run it. And although we were nearly killed and the boat was battered mightily, we all survived. We stopped immediately on the shore, and we fired our rifles repeatedly in hopes of signaling the men who were climbing out that they could come back and rejoin us, and we were probably fine now. But either they didn't hear us, or they chose not to hear us, and we never saw them again. The next day we came out, the next day, and my friend Brigham Young had sent down a small party of fishermen to wait for us at the mouth of the Virgin River. He told them if they survived, help them, and if they're dead, try to rescue their journals and maps. And that night we had our first good meal in 2 months. My brother Walter and I made our way back to Salt Lake City, where we discovered that the newspapers had declared us dead many months previously. I sent a telegram to my wife and corrected some of those news reports. And I discovered now that I was something of a national hero. One-armed Civil War veteran goes down the Colorado River backwards in a boat. And after this, congressional appropriations came my way, and I became the first director of the U.S. Bureau of Ethnography, and I became the second director of the U.S. Geological Survey, and I became the water czar for the American West for 13 years, and probably the most important government scientist in the United States. I moved to Washington, D.C. In Washington, D.C., which was a dreary little government town, I helped to create the Cosmos Club, which was a club for like-minded men to gather and over ale to discuss scientific ideas. And I helped to create the National Geographic Society so that we could stand up in the world's arena as a serious nation of serious geographers. And I went out back into the West 20 or 30 times for the rest of my life. I learned 10 or 11 or 12 Indian languages, mostly Ute and Paiute. I should tell you what happened to the three men. As soon as we got to Salt Lake City, I began to make inquiries. It turns out that they had been killed They were killed by a group of Shivwits Indians. Shivwits are a band of the Paiute. And so I went to investigate the following spring, and I learned Shivwits so that I could do it. And what they told me was that a Shivwits girl had been molested by a white man, and that they assumed that these were the culprits, and they killed them. I don't believe that my men would have done that. They were good men. And the Shivwits admitted that it might have been a Mormon settler. But it was a misunderstanding, and I forgave them, but it was a sad ending to my voyage. If the men had stayed with me and not deserted, we all would have lived. But their deaths, I think, came from a cultural misunderstanding. And I want to close with that thought. I became probably the most significant anthropologist of my era with respect to Western Indians. I learned a series of their languages, and I spent a great amount of time taking down their culture. And here's why I was successful, I think. First of all, I never traveled with a military escort. I was constantly being urged to take a military escort for security's sake. I said, no, what signal do you suppose that gives the Indians? You show up with a small army, you can't expect them to trust you now. Secondly, as I said, I learned their languages. And when you learn their languages, you not only can pick up nuance that cannot be translated, but it's a sign of respect. And that respect encourages them to tell you stories that they might not otherwise tell. And third, I never judge them. When they tell me their origin stories about how Coyote dove down into the center of the world and came up with a little piece of mud from which he made humankind, I don't sneer at that. And frankly, our own origin story is not much different from that. And so I never judge this. I just assume it that each culture has its own mythologies and that irrationality is at the center of these things. And I never overreacted. You know, what bothered me was that we took the continent from Indians, broke all of our treaties, of course, made promises that we didn't keep about annuities and so on, and then we herded them on to the worst possible lands of the continent, lands that no white man wanted, spoil lands, things, just remnant lands. We herded them off onto these impossible reservations and then said, now you're on your own. When they failed, we blame them as if it's their own fault. And so often we overreact to border situations. I wrote an article for Century Magazine, and this is what I said. Some hungry Indian steals a beef. Some tired Indian steals a horse. Some vicious Indian commits a depredation and flies to the mountains. No effort is made to find the real offender, but the first Indian met with is shot on sight. The Indians retaliate. And now the news is spread that war has broken out on the frontier. Troops are sent. They march around the mountains and return. Perhaps a few Indians are killed, and perhaps a few white men. Usually in all such cases, the white man is the chief sufferer because he has property that can be destroyed, while the Indian has none that he cannot easily hide among the rocks and trees. And his methods of warfare are such that we cannot cope with him without resorting to methods that are repugnant to civilized life. And after spending thousands or even millions of dollars on an affair that at its inception was a petty larceny, we enter into negotiations with the Indians and make promises of land which we cannot keep, and rations and annuities, the cost of which would be a burden on the public treasury. We have to get over that cycle of overreacting to skirmishes on the frontier. And so my ethnology is as important to me as the trip, And I believe that the anthropology that I engaged in will have a lasting influence on the way we see those Great Basin and Colorado Plateau cultures. The last thing I will say before taking your questions is that I studied water, and I realized around 1876 that the 100th meridian, which goes through Bismarck, North Dakota, and Pierre, South Dakota, and North Platte, Nebraska, that that's the line of demarcation, that east of the 100th meridian there's plenty of water for wheat or corn, but west of the 100th meridian there isn't. Now there is, of course, in Washington State, but not in most of the American West. And because of that fact, because the western 40% of continental U.S. is too dry for regular agriculture, we must create a new system for development there, because if we just take a couple from Norway or from Denmark and bring them out and put them on 160 acres in Utah, they're going to starve to death. And so I wrote something called the Arid Lands Report. I think it's my most important piece of work. And I suggested that we create a whole new development pattern for the lands beyond the 100th meridian. But nobody listened. And you continued to follow the Jeffersonian system of land development, and it caused tragedy for tens of thousands of honest settlers from Europe and from the eastern states and the United States. All right, so now I'll take some questions. If you want to come up to the microphone, do. I'll take a few questions, then I want to break character and talk a little bit, and I want to apologize for my voice. You probably have some sense that I'm not at full par. I was dunked in the river so many times on this journey that my voice has never really recovered. I apologize. I know it's probably irritating, but I'm going to take a few questions, and then I'm going to take about 20 minutes out of character. Go ahead, sir. Yes, Theodore Roosevelt and I were members of the Cosmos Club. We traveled in the same intellectual circles in Washington, D.C. We both had strong opinions about Indians. Roosevelt, I won't tell you what Roosevelt's opinions about Indians are because they're so ungenerous, but he did not like hyphenated Americans. He didn't like Irish Americans. He didn't like German Americans. He didn't like Bohemian Americans. He didn't like Italian Americans, and he didez like Shoshone or Nez Perce Americans. He wanted every American to be a full patriot who left their ethnicity at the door. I think that's a heartless view. I admired Roosevelt, and of course he was a man of extraordinary physical capacity and a great writer. But I think he's a little too jingoistic for me, always looking for a war. And I think his belief that the Anglo-Saxon people have a special place in God's heart, I find hard to square with any rational understanding of God.
Thank you, Major Pell. I was just down in that gorgeous area a little over a month ago, and one of the things we did was take a boat ride on Lake Powell. I wanted to ask you how you feel about having that lake named after you.
Yes, how do I feel about having Lake Powell named after me? And Lake Powell, as you know, flooded Glen Canyon, one of the most beautiful canyons on the Colorado River. I'm probably going to disappoint you. I believe that if you want that land west of the 100th meridian to bloom, you have to irrigate 100%. In other words, you have to carry every cubic inch of water up out of its stream and put it on the benchlands above. And if you don't, you can't make it possible for people to live in this arid country. And so I'm in favor of industrial irrigation. Now, I learned a lot from the Hopi systems and from the Mormon systems. It doesn't have to be industrial gigantism, but I believe that we need as many dams as possible in the West. And during the 14 years that I was America's first water czar, as the director of the U.S. Geological Survey, I actually designated 218 potential dam sites across the American West, including in the Grand Canyon, and including in Glen Canyon. And so Lake Powell is not as odd as it might seem. I'm a romantic in that I got to float down that great river. I was the first person ever to do so. But I'm a utilitarian, too. And I know that the world must be fed, and there are millions of people who want opportunity to have their own little farms, and all the farms in Iowa and Illinois are taken up. And so if we're going to make the desert bloom, we're going to have to build dams in places that are very beautiful. So, I'll say furthermore, and certainly disappointing some of you, but I believe that any cubic inch of water that reaches the sea unused has been wasted. We need to irrigate the West if we want to create something like Jeffersonian civilization here. Go ahead. Now the boats, I can tell you this, they're wooden dories. Three were oak and one was pine. And they had compartments. They had three compartments, and the middle was open, but they had watertight compartments, which were meant to make them more floatable. But the thing you need to realize is that when you go down the river, you tend to go in a raft. So you're going face forward. We were looking face backward because you don't get enough rowing power if you're facing the current. And so we're constantly looking over our shoulder as we're going down these precipitous rapids. So it's a very silly way to do things. And today you wouldn't even be allowed to do it without very special license. And we didn't have any life preservers of any sort. On the second journey, they brought me a little life preserver that was a little rubber donut, and I could stick it over one shoulder. Because I wanted to be able to see more of the river, on the second journey I had a chair like this lashed to the top deck of the Emma Dean, and I sat on it. But the center of gravity was so high that it was really quite a dangerous ride. So we went down, and so what would happen is we would move down and we'd go through calm water, and when we'd see the beginnings of a rapids, I'd do the flag signal and we'd go to shore. We'd scramble out and look at the lie of the land, and then we would either run it occasionally or we would line the boats down on ropes, so you have men half a mile down and you line the boat and they grab the rope and they send it farther, but you're always holding onto the rope if you can. Or in a few extreme situations, we portaged and had to carry everything up and around a sheer cliff. So it's tedious because there are hundreds and hundreds of rapids on the Green and the Colorado rivers, and we became somewhat reckless as the journey went on and ran things that we probably shouldn't have. But even with that, you're spending about half the day on the shore stretching out ropes and hoping that your boats aren't simply smashed by the force of the river. Any other questions for this phase? Yes, you're the last question there.
What did you use to repair your boats when they were leaking? Tools and...
We had a full set of tools, of course. And so the boats would begin to have gaps and holes in them, and we would cut little pieces of wood and wedge them in. And we would get the pine resin from pine trees and use it as a kind of caulking device, and we had some tar that we had brought with us for caulking. But mostly you just pound in little wedges of wood into all the holes, and you do this three or four times a day towards the end of the trip because the boats are just broken down. They're barely floating. And so we were wet all of the time. On a trip like that, you're never really dry. And the food was wet all of the time. And sour flour is really very distasteful flour. But we had no choice. And so we had tools. We lost all of our paddles very early and had to recreate them out of whatever wood we could find in the river. Finding wood in the river is not that easy either, because there's much more wood in the Colorado canyons in your time than there ever was in mine because of the introduction of foreign species and also the damming, the regulation of those, of the discharges. And so it's made a huge difference. But we had a very difficult time finding lumber. And I think in one of the passages that I recited, I said we found driftwood that had been caught. You know, rising water lodges it in a tree or lodges it in a crevice of the rock, and then you go gather that wood. But it was not very often long enough to produce a sturdy or interesting paddle. So let me close this portion of the program by just saying this, that, you know, I'm known mostly for the great journey of 1869. I did a second one in 1871 and 72. But I wanted to use my fame, if you call it that, to advance the civilization of the American West. And I saw a couple of things that were needed. One was a realistic development protocol so that a person who homesteaded would have an actual chance of success. And so in the Arid Lands Report, I suggested that instead of 160 acres arbitrarily placed on the map, that every deeded piece of land, every homestead should have access to water, that we should never deed out a homestead that had no access to water, and that you can't alienate water rights from land rights, that the water rights stay with the land. And I also suggested that we get rid of the cadastral survey grid of townships and square miles and so on and replace it with a French-style long lot system where it's like a balloon. Every homestead has 10 or 20 acres on a creek, and then it balloons up and widens out away from that creek. And I suggested that a ranch, which is really the only thing you can do in most of the lands west of the 100th meridian, that a ranch should be a minimum of four sections, 2,500 acres, not 160. So I had a whole series of proposals in the Arid Land Report that were designed to rethink our development patterns. You know, the great Jefferson, and I'm a great admirer of Jefferson, but Jefferson never saw Utah. He never saw Nevada. He never saw Wyoming. He had no idea how dry and rugged and inhospitable the West was. And so the development protocols, you'd call it software, that Jefferson devised in the late 18th century worked for Ohio and Indiana, but it breaks down almost immediately when you get to western Colorado or Wyoming. And so instead of setting up people for failure, I wanted to reform our system so that we could do it in a way that really gave people a chance to thrive. I was completely ignored. No one listened to me. And I went finally to the Second International Irrigation Congress in 1893, and I was the grand old man, the hero of the river, but increasingly seen as a creature from an earlier era. And I listened to all of the boosters talking about development schemes day after day. And I stood up and I actually got booed off the stage, and I said, "Gentlemen, if you attempt a fraction of these projects, you will find that there's not enough water in the American West to do them. You are heaping up a legacy of conflict and litigation. If you took every cubic inch out of every stream in the West, you might irrigate 3 to 10%. But the great bulk of the lands of the West will never be available for irrigation. And so don't use pseudoscience." Well, there was a theory in my time, which was, it's so insane that I can hardly allow myself to say it, but people argued that rain follows the plow. That if you plow up Colorado, it frets the earth and rain will fall. I don't know if you've ever seen in your own time pseudoscientists telling you what you want to hear instead of what you need to hear about the carrying capacity of the world. So that was one of my major themes. And I wanted to replace blockish states like Colorado with what I called watershed commonwealths. There would be a Snake River Commonwealth. And there would be a Missouri Commonwealth and a Colorado Commonwealth and a Sacramento Commonwealth and a San Juan Commonwealth, but each river basin would be holistically governed as a unit, as a watershed. I said this would prevent the kind of insane conflict and litigation that has occurred between the upper basin and the lower basin and the Colorado system. And the second thing that I was so eager to do was to somehow to lighten the impact of our development on Indians. It's clear we're going to take the continent. But we should be able to do this in a way that shows the best qualities of the American spirit and not just the worst ones. And so I made that a huge priority in my life. And again, I wasn't particularly successful. I think what you discover is that when humans are actuated by greed, there's almost nothing that will stop them, including science. I know that's a sober note to end on, but I do. I'm going to pull my arm out of my... I just want to break character for a minute. Thank you. I want to say a couple of things myself. First of all, I'm so glad to be here. This is the highlight of my year every year. I come here at the Seattle Public Library. I spend a week. I do a whole series of different things in the community. And this time, I've been here for 9 days. And I did 4 different characters. I did Meriwether Lewis, which is a huge costume of buckskins. And I did John Wesley Powell with this appalling beard. How the 19th century thought that was a good thing. I can't stand it. And when you come down the elevator in the hotel, it's just a nightmare because they're always about to push the 911 security number. And then I did Jefferson and Powell and Theodore Roosevelt with chaps and cowboy boots. And so I have like 75 pounds of leather in my suitcases. It's just hell at TSA. You know, it's bad enough to travel with 1 costume, but 4. And you just feel kind of horrible in a certain way when you dress up like that. The concierge in my hotel, staying at the Sheridan, I'd come down and I'd be Thomas Jefferson. And she'd sort of look at me, and then the next day I'd come down, I was Theodore Roosevelt and wearing spurs and a gun, you know, and then I'd come down as this river rat. It's no fun. And Chris Higashi, who is one of my dearest friends, you see what she's done to me. They blew my voice. I finally talked myself out. And so I'm so sorry that my voice isn't stronger today. I hope you could at least hear what I was trying to say. And it's, oh, thanks. But I feel like I've cheated you in a certain way because I didn't have my voice. Usually I have an entirely untrained voice, but it works for me. It's a good little tool, and it's really all I have. And when it goes out, as it does about once every 3 years, it's no fun. So I've been gargling Listerine 24 hours a day, and I'm so high on whatever those lozenges are that I was fainting dead away in the elevator earlier. But I wanted to tell you a couple of things before we go. First of all, how much I love it here. This is my favorite place to come, not just Seattle, but the town hall and the Seattle Public Library. For me, it's like the highlight of my travel year. And I think it's the most Jeffersonian place in the country. Your readers, and that really makes a difference. Did you see that statistic the other day that said 27% of the American people did not read a book last year? But that's not even the real statistic, because imagine the next 27% who read a book on International Harvester tractors of the 50s, or, you know, so if you actually got to the point of who read a book, I'm sure that's a very small minority, and it really, really worries me. But of all the places in the country, I think Seattle is the readingest, and I just love that. I wanted to tell you a little bit about my life as a gardener. Some of you know that I come from a family of gardeners. My grandmother was a great gardener. And so this year, I had two gardens. I had a Jefferson garden, and I had a regular garden. And the Jefferson garden, I worked this out with Monticello, and I sent them mandan, hidatsa, and ericaris seeds from North Dakota, the kind that Lewis and Clark gathered. And they send me heritage seeds from Monticello, and we all grow them at the same time and compare notes. So I had that garden. I call it my Square Nine garden because Jefferson had one of his gardens, which he called Square Nine for experimental purposes. And then I had my huge garden. This year I canned 190 quarts of tomato sauce, tomato juice, tomatoes, and I'll tell you, plus 190 quarts of pickles and tomato sauce and tomato juice, and then 24 bags, quart-sized bags of cream corn. Have you ever made homemade cream corn? Well, it is the greatest thing ever. It is like candy. It is to cream corn what cream corn is to grits. It's absolutely amazing. So now I have this. It's in my kitchen table. My whole kitchen table is this mountain of mason jars. And my mother came by last week, and she said, well, what are you going to do with them? And I said, I'm going to just hoard them. and she said, well, what's the point of hoarding them? And I said, well, maybe the end times are coming. And when they do, I'll be selling tomato sauce for $500 a quart. But I can't bear to open them because it was so much work to can them. And I'm just so proud of myself for canning them. So my goal is to have like 10,000 jars. And then and only then to be able to draw down for the rest of my life, you know. So next year I'm going to do, I planted 4 new rhubarb plants. You've ever had canned rhubarb? Oh my, that's about as good as anything you ever get. So this whole Jeffersonian thing has really been heating up. And then I was involved with, so I'm just trying to catch you up on my bad life. I was involved in the HBO Lewis and Clark miniseries. They've been working on it for years. And I was up in Calgary, Ontario twice this summer for it. And they were going to use Casey Affleck as Lewis. And so I met him, my 20-year-old daughter met him and fell in love with him and so on. But the film is sort of stalled out now. They fired the director. And so I don't know if it'll ever be built. But they're planning to start again in 2017. And then I just came back from Chicago where I was interviewed for an American Experience documentary on Theodore Roosevelt and the River of Doubt. You know, the 1914 journey on the last uncharted river in South America. So that should be coming out next year. So that's pretty much where things stand. Does anyone have a question for me as a scholar? If you do, come up. We'll just take about 5 or 6 more minutes. Let's go ahead, sir.
We've really so much enjoyed the very different characters that you've brought to us. It's an amazing way for us to really be present in the history. But I'm wondering, have you ever really started in to research someone thinking, oh, this is going to be a good one for me to deal with? And you get into it and say, no, I don't think so. And I'm not talking about Eleanor Roosevelt. You might even be able to do that.
No, the question is, do I ever start down the path of researching somebody and then think better of it? Well, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but one year I was just minding my own business, and I got a call from that's football. you take it seriously enough, do you? The Air Force is flying sorties over the town hall because you have a football team. I watch your game sometimes, you know, and it's like, I don't know what happened to you because, you know, a lot of Portland and Seattle all usually have sort of higher, mediocre sorts of teams, and then suddenly the Seahawks became like football on steroids, and we all were forced to bow to you, and there was that whole period where you were just so full of yourselves about this. And Seattle this, and then this year you're just pathetic. And yet you can't just say, oh my goodness, we're back to normal now. What is it with you in this sport? I'm close to the Minnesota Vikings, the Denver Broncos, and the Green Bay Packers, but for none of those other teams is there this sort of, you know, the 12th man. It seems like it kind of takes away from the reading a city in America. What could be worse than being strafed during a humanities program? No wonder ISIS is winning, you know. Wow. I can't even believe that. But anyway, so the phone rang and this woman called and she was from Iowa and she said, I represent the American Association of Presbyterian Churches. Would you be willing to perform as John Calvin for our annual conference? And I said, tell me more. And she said, there'll be like 5,000 people there. Presbyterians from all over the country, some of the nicest people you ever meet, and they would like to hear from Calvin, so would you do it? So my actual field, English Renaissance literature, covers Calvin. And so I thought, I've done Jefferson, and I've done Meriwether Lewis, and I've done this and that. It's the first time anyone's asked me to do something I theoretically am supposed to know about. I guess I'll do it. So I spent a year getting ready. And the costume's the easy part of that. And I read, it was those 10 biographies of Calvin, and I read his institutes, and I read his letters, and I read secondary and tertiary studies of the Reformation, and I got all hepped up about it. And I went to Des Moines for this big event. There were 4,000 of them in this room. And I started in on Calvin. And within seconds, it became clear to them that they didn't like Calvin. Because Calvin was not a very likable man, you know. So, and I'm about 20 minutes in, and I'm burning Michael Servetus at the stake for heresy, and I'm just cheerfully going along, burning heretics and torturing people I don't like, and peering into people's bedroom windows, and I look out on these Midwestern Presbyterians, and they're just absolutely appalled, and I wanted to say, well, who do you think he was? You know, have you never looked him up? He was not a nice man. And so they were, afterwards the woman came up to me and said, I've never seen so many unhappy Presbyterians. I said, what do you want me to do? Turn it into a rotary gate, you know? Just do the nice six things that Calvin ever did. But, you know, Calvin believed that he's an Augustinian. So Calvin believed that before God created you, he pre-decided to save a few of you, and he pre-decided to damn most of you. It gets worse. So before he created you, he had predetermined to damn most of you to eternal hell, but a few of you he was going to give grace to, but through no merit of your own. You all deserve hell, but out of his infinite goodness, he selected one out of a million of you to save. and that you can't earn salvation, and if you're Hitler, you might be saved, and if you're Mother Teresa, you might be damned. This is known as double predestination. And so I'm just cheerfully rattling this off, because I thought, you know, if you invite someone to do Calvin, you're going to get Calvin. So that was a one-gig character. And so you know, at the time, it seemed like such a great thing to do. I've done a number of characters like that. I did Jonathan Swift. And I don't know if you know Swift, but Gulliver's Travels is one of my very favorite books. I read it at least once every 2 years. It's not a children's book. And there's a famous essay about him called The Excremental Vision. And Swift was locked into some sort of infantile, excremental phase of his development. He somehow got stuck at about the age of 2, psychologically, and so his poems and Gulliver and A Tale of a Tub and all these are just filled with excremental references. If you remember the Yahoos in book 4, they're throwing turds at people. It's just, Swift just gets into this sort of sexual fantasy about excrement. And so he wrote this poem about a woman at her dressing table, and he was trying to make fun of pastoral poetry about shepherdesses, and her name was Celia. And the last two lines of the poem are, something, something, something fits, oh Celia, 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 shits. And I did this in a tent in Reno, Nevada, and these people just got up and walked out like I would make this up, you know. I made that shit poem up about Swift. So now I don't let anyone tell me what to do anymore, because it comes out so badly. You know, I worked on William Shirer, who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich and The Berlin Diary and the 3-volume autobiography, one of the most amazing men who ever lived. I did one program. You think, wow, that's a lot of work for one, you know? So you have to be very careful. Go ahead.
Firstly, congratulations on the pickles. My grandmother came from Fargo and taught me to make pickles. I'm curious to know, I had forgotten that Powell was instrumental in founding the National Geographic Society.
Right.
And I was curious, particularly given the recent acquisition of National Geographic as a publication by Rupert Murdoch, I was wondering if you would speak a little bit about the role of a private scientific institution like the Geographic. It's not a government organization, and I think that it has transformed a lot over its history.
It has. I'm not an expert on the National Geographic Society. I've given talks for them as Powell, and of course, it's a really interesting story of how all this began, and Powell really was much more than just this adventurer. That's the point of my talk. But, you know, some of you probably have a complete run of National Geographic. Some people do. You know, the first 50 or 60 years were so valuable. It was really a very important magazine then, and it sort of went the way of everything else in the end of the 20th century, the way of People magazine and USA Today. It got lighter and fluffier and more colorful and less interesting. It's the nature of marketing. It's too bad, but if you go back, I mean, some of the most important articles ever done were on geography in the Western Hemisphere were first published in National Geographic. And Theodore Roosevelt has an NGS moment, because when he came back from the River of Doubt in 1914, he lost a quarter of his body weight, 58 pounds, nearly died. But he gave a talk to the National Geographic Society in Washington, D.C. in May of 1914, and some armchair geographers had poo-pooed his thing and said, oh, he's probably mistaken. It's probably not even a unique river. He's surely exaggerating the distance. And, you know, what can a former president do by way of exploration? And Roosevelt gave a talk so great that they all shut up and praised him. And Roosevelt, I mean, he just nailed it in his talk before the, he used chalkboards and drew tributaries and so on. And he was visual proof of the ordeal he had been through. His clothes were just hanging off him like he was in a tent or something. And so there's that era between the founding of NGS in 1878 and sort of its high water mark just after World War I is a very fascinating era in American intellectual history. And Powell was part of it, Henry Adams was part of it, John Hay was part of it, Theodore Roosevelt was part of it, and a range of others. You get the last word.
In your research, how closely are you able to physically follow the paths your explorers took?
How do I physically follow these paths? Well, thanks for asking that. My friend Becky is here. Where's Becky? Right there. So we do these summer tours. We go on the Lewis and Clark Trail every summer. So this summer we'll be going for 3 days on the wild and scenic portion of the Missouri River, the White Cliffs area, the most beautiful part of the Missouri that you can only get to by canoe. And then we come in and we spend 4 days up on the Lolo Trail just inside Idaho, which is the most pristine hiking zone on the Lewis and Clark Trail. So every year we go, and I can promise you, you actually step in the footsteps of Lewis and Clark. We camp where they camped. We can read their descriptions and know we're exactly in those scenes. And so my work on Meriwether Lewis extends back 30 years or more, and I've traveled the trail in all sorts of different ways and flown over it in airplanes and kayaked it and been in steamboats or fake steamboats in the lower Columbia and really explored that in every possible way. Then Becky and I led a John Wesley Powell trip through Desolation Canyon in Utah a few years ago, and it was like the trip from hell. I mean, it was like the last chapters of the Book of Revelation, the opening of the fifth seal, and then the opening of the sixth seal. I'm not kidding. We had locusts. We had actual locusts, and they were like covering the earth. And that was one day, and then the next day we had a flash flood. And it rained like 3 inches in 20 minutes, and whole chunks of Utah were floating past us, and trees and mountains, and there was a mutiny. There was a mutiny in the crew, and this woman who had just gotten a divorce was celebrating her 50th birthday. She brought her two young sons, and she, on her birthday, she went to her tent. It's all outfitted, so you don't have to do any work on these trips. She went to her tent and she put on this beautiful sort of red sheath and had this bottle of champagne, and then the flash flood just swept her. It just swept her into the river. It was a great trip, but so we do that, and next year we're going to Jefferson in France, in Paris, and on the Canal du Midi. So we do that for J. Robert Oppenheimer. I went to Alamogordo. They open up the test site where the atomic bomb was detonated twice per year, on the first Saturday in April and the first Saturday in October, and I've been to that. Of course, I go to Monticello all the time. I'm going to Rome next Friday for 3 weeks, and while I'm there, I'm going to travel up to Vicenza, which is the home of Andrea Palladio, Jefferson's guru. And there's an exhibit at Jefferson and Andrea Palladio, architectural exhibit there this winter, so I'm going to go up and see that. So, you know, this is all just a pathetic tax write-off kind of a thing, but but I have this great life. Everything I do, I can somehow figure out a historical angle, and so that's the fun of it. I mean, most of what I do involves reading. You know, so you just read, and memorize, and take notes, and so on. But some of it is the sort of you are there feel to it, and that's really a very exciting part of what I get to do. And so I haven't been to Jefferson's France for 5 or 6 years now. I can't wait to do that. But the Lewis and Clark trip, if you've never been on it, That's quite a trip. Several people in the audience have done it. We do this. It's a life-changing trip. It's all outfitted. At the end of the day, there are hors d'oeuvres and wine, and your tent is set up. And you know, it's not exactly roughing it, but we go to this lodge near Missoula called Laksa Lodge. And then the next morning, we do something that's called the Wendover Death March. It's 9 miles straight up. And every year I say, never again, never ever again. And every year I do. Because you're right, you're walking exactly in the footsteps of Lewis and Clark. And the last thing I'll say, and then you can buy books and we can just chat or whatever, is that in January, I do two retreats at this lodge west of Missoula. It's called Laksa Lodge. You can Google it. And 4 days we do on Walden, on Thoreau's Walden, which I think is America's greatest book. And then the second week, these are unrelated. Some people come to both. But the second week of 4 days, we do this year Books of the Road. So it'll be The Odyssey by Homer, Huckleberry Finn, On the Road, which is one of my favorite books, and then two by Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath and Travels with Charlie. And so 16 to 20 people come. It's not pretentious or anything. We just sit around this lodge and talk about ideas for 4 days, and it's just, it's like the book club you wish you were in, because you all know the book club you're actually in. Where you go and you just wind up drinking wine because no one read it. This is the book club you wish you were in. We just have the most tremendous time. So if you're interested in that, on the summer trip or the France trip or the two winter retreats at Laksa Lodge, see Becky. She'll be at the table with my assistant Nancy. But I just want to say this in closing. First of all, happy Thanksgiving. It's my favorite holiday of the year because it's the only one we haven't ruined. And secondly, I won't even tell you my mother's plans. My mother is 84, and she said to me the other day, I'm leaving for Rome the next day, she said, how about if we just buy a turkey breast? And I said, how about just you stay home? What kind of idiot would just buy a turkey breast? I mean, why even have Thanksgiving? Well, here's your turkey breast, you know. I mean, that's just nuts. And then she's going to make her famous pumpkin pie. She said, I'll go to the store and buy the crust. I said, don't bother, you know. I can go to Denny's and get that pie. So, but I wish you well on your own Thanksgiving, because mine is clearly going to suck this year. But I'm going to serve her pickles from my garden, and I'm going to serve her beets. She loves canned beets. I canned some beets for her, and I'm going to serve her this cream corn, which is just to die for. And so I'm hoping that she'll allow me to have a full turkey under such circumstances. But I want to apologize to you for the corrupt state of my voice. I hate to disappoint, but thank you for bearing with me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, please leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Tune in again soon for another great talk. Till then, good listening and safe travels.